So Robin gets there. He's having wonderful standing room only classes. Mm-hmm. And people are clamoring for Jack Spicer's collected works. And,
yes.
And yeah. getting to the point where they're getting a little pissed off at Robin for not
they
getting on the job.
Are. Yes. Yes.
But he completes it.
He does complete it. And
Black Sparrow Press publishes it. Yeah. It's a beautiful, it still is a beautiful book, mm-hmm. even though there's an updated version. But also he puts in the essay, The Practice of yes. Outside. So
I think there are a couple of factors that slow things down. One of them was just simply the way Robin worked. It took him a long time to get things done because he liked to spend a lot of time reading and writing and thinking about it, right? Much slower pace than what we ask of academics these days. And he was never a real career academic anyway. He was a poet. So he wanted to get it right for Jack. And then there was the case of publishers. If you look at the correspondence around that period, which is again in special collections at SFU, he tried out a few. You know, there was, I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but there was, he was talking to Nathaniel Mackey at Nathaniel Tarn, that was it, sorry. Nathaniel Tarn about publishing with Tarn's Press in London, and then he was corresponding with Knopf, I think it was. And these were, you know, how these things take time, right? They take up where you write the letters and some editor considers it and so on and so forth. And one of the other, these presses dropped out until he found Black Sparrow, who was willing to put it forward. Right? And of course, the other thing was that he was a full-time professor. Mm. And that slowed him down too, just the job. He often complained about the workload he had when he first came to Simon Fraser, that it was really quite extensive. I mean, Simon Fraser, and I don't know the history of this, they negotiated a contract at some point or another where they got a very good deal, better than UBC. So the full course load for SFU right now is four courses a year, two and two. That's without any course releases for special researches, you know, projects or anything. Most institutions don't have that. But he remembers, and it might have been because he was hired simply on a temporary basis at first. I had to do 9 courses. I filled in for, you know. So he was talking about that too. And then his personal life was rather chaotic during that time. So those are all things that went into the, slowing down. Took 10 years. It's 1975.
Talk about the essay, The Practice of Outside.
Well, if you think about 1975, so that essay was being written in about 72, 73. It was controversial for some of Spicer readers at the time because they thought that he had over-theorized Spicer. It's full of Merleau-Ponty, you know, full of Michel Foucault. And it was pretty early on the academic horizon to be using those writers as fully as he had. He was really on top of it in terms of reading the stuff that was coming out of France, the new philosophies that were coming out of France, the Foucaults and the Lacans and the Merleau-Pontys. And so he read, as he says, I think, at the beginning of that essay, that it wasn't to explicate Spicer. It was, again, to provide context for him. I don't know of a Blazer essay where he actually explicates. He provides context, and then that, for him, lets the work speak. So he wanted to provide, I think, that kind of a setting for Spicer, because it would get at the long reach, that it wasn't simply a lyricism that only went as far as Spicer's desire. That it had longer and larger implications, you know. So, yes. And he did get a lot of flack for that. that Spicer himself would not have appreciated all that theory, all that philosophy going into the, you know, contextualizing of his work. But for Robin, I think it was important. But it was also important to use that theory to say where we were at that particular point, it's 1975, in terms of cultural movements, you know, and where Spicer fit in to all that. Mm-hmm. One of the overarching narratives, I think, in Robin's thinking, this is in the essays as well as the poems, is that when you lose a commonly accepted view of the sacred, you lose all the fixed relationships, right, that you have.
Everything's up for grabs.
Yes, and it all has to be worked out. Hence, as I said earlier, performance. You perform the real, you know? It's not just given to you like a gift. You perform it. And so Spicer's devotion to the real, you know, what does that mean? Why? Why would you have to do that? Or why would you have to seek out the real? Because it's not self-evident. It's not given.
Not a given.
Yeah. Right. And so he wanted to get that, like, he wanted to get the seriousness of Spicer in, I think, in that essay. At least that's what the essay says to me. You know, he and I never talked about it in terms of, you know, my interpretation of that essay. As a matter of fact, we never talked about interpretation together. You know, we talked about context, but I never said, you know, did you mean this or did you mean that? It didn't work like that with him, right? He would say things like, oh, is that what I meant? You know, he'd read something I'd written. Isn't that nice?
Right. I can neither confirm nor deny.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
We've kind of skipped around the whole deconstructionist thing.
Yes.
You point out in the book that here he is, a member of the New American Poetry, and here he is also living at a time where language poetry was front and center in the avant-garde.
Yeah.
And Duncan certainly had some thoughts about that.
Yes, he did, yeah.
Just ask Baron Watton.
Yeah.
He did not read the French deconstructionist philosophers, and we're talking about Deleuze and Lacan and Merleau-Ponty and this gang, I guess, Foucault, this gang, I'm just going to use that phrase. He didn't see them as a rejection of his poetics, but as a confirmation.
Well, he pulled them under his own territory, you know? He was sneaky that way. That's what he did with philosophy. Instead of saying, oh, you know, how does my poetry fit into this philosophical narrative? He would never say that. He would say, oh, you know, that he would look at those elements in whatever philosopher he was reading that seemed to him companionable, would have been the word he would use to his poetry. So it was always he pulled it onto poetry's territory.
I think the story that best illustrates what we're talking about is the Spicer conference in which he and Ron Silliman had the same title. Is it?
Yes. Yes, my vocabulary did this to me.
Yeah. Can you give us the nutshell version?
Yeah, well, that was a bit of a shocker at the time. I was there, I was a student. But there he was, and Ron Silliman was...
This is in San Francisco?
It's in San Francisco in 86, yeah. Silliman was a very, you know, very important avant-garde poet of the moment, right? He was a poet of the moment, definitely. And here was this conference on Spicer, and I think that Silliman's paper kind of claims Spicer for language poetry as a precursor of language poetry, because, well, certainly there's truth to that, that Spicer was a linguist, he was trained as a linguist, and he understood, you know, language from that linguist perspective.
Studied with Jaime D'Angulo.
Ah.
Who was an amateur anthropologist,
mm-hmm.
who understood many of these or learned many of these native languages from Northern California.
Right.
30 of them,
yes.
And one in
yes.
New Mexico.
Yeah.
So that's who Spicer studied linguistics with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, impressive.
It is impressive. So he does have a background which you could see would lend itself to language poetry.
Sure.
However, that's not how Robin would see
no,
it.
No, and I think Robin would, you know, he got in there on that occasion. Really, it was a scene for 1986. Language poetry was really at its, almost the height of its power in terms of a, you know, very engaging and attractive
movement.
Avant-garde poetic movement, right? Mm-hmm. And there was the New American Poetry had kind of fallen off the table in terms of its popularity and so on. And there he is talking about Spicer's mysticism, right? The parallels between Spicer's practice, poetic practice, and the practice of a mystic, and he's using Michel de Certeau to do it, which again is one of those sneaky moves, because you take a very contemporary, theorist and say, look, you know, he would claim him for his own poetics, for his own point of view, where others might have said, well, you know, that kind of theory really sort of, calls your work and or challenges your work in some way or another. So I thought it was, those two papers side by side, you know, really two very different views of what Spicer was all about, and two different ways to deal with, I think, what deconstruction was going to get at, which was to try to take apart the ego, try to take apart the unitary I, that, you know, decenter the self, decenter the cogito. Robin had a different way of doing that. And
through the practice of outside.
The practice of outside, that's right. Yeah.
And instead of pulling a Duncan and Barrett Watton, where he's, getting physically violent, although it was probably a push or something like that, Robin hugs Ron Silliman. He says, we're the same person. Is that what he says?
Oh, he said, the effect was two halves of the same man, you know? We're two halves of the same man.
Right.
If you actually think about that statement for a bit, it was off the cuff, and it was meant to deflect, I think.
Disarm the tension.
Yeah, it was meant to disarm the tension. As I read it, it was meant to disarm. It was a charm, you know?
Right.
And it did the job. In some ways, I don't know whether that was a good thing. Maybe the fight should have happened, or there should have been a fight, or there should have been more, you know, talk about it to have drawn out the real differences there. But it really is the two halves of the same man, or just one man in total. I think it's like you're going at things from two different angles. One, both of you are interested in process, and both of you are trying to decenter the power of the word, this transparent word. The word is transparent to itself, right? And how do you do that? Well, people are familiar with the deconstructive way and the language way, where you really undo. It's a negation of all those things. That's the philosophical way, is the negative, right? Robin didn't think that was really, I don't know what the right word is exactly, honest to experience, that he figured that you had to have, that willy-nilly you would have experience. He says in the Stadium of the Mirror, poetry is always about experience, always about it, you know? So what you have to do is, again, to go back to that notion of polarity, you have to tie the voice that you want to be, that you want to decenter, to its other.
Mm-hmm. How to live rather than what can be known.
Exactly.
As I think how you say it in the book.
Yeah. There was a different focus. And Robin never denounced language poetry. He was friends. He was friends with Bernstein,
who writes in the Holy Forest, and also says that Robin, it's a secular vision. How does he get away with saying that?
A secular vision, because Robin wanted to put the sacred back in the secular where he thought it belonged, instead of, you know.
Is it? It's not a denial in Bernstein's view, because Bernstein is not exactly you know, the most devout person.
No.
You know what I mean?
No. I think...
And the whole, all of language poetry is an extension of there is no God, there is no divine.
There is no divine, there's no vertical, you know. And so I think it is, again, it's a difference in strategy and tonality and temperament. I couldn't imagine Charles Bernstein... you know, using the kind of language that Robin uses, like with the capital O, other, or language is a throne of the other. How grand that sounds, you know. Mm-hmm. Bernstein wouldn't, no. Would not, that would be anathema, because it sounds too, I don't know, maybe pretentious from his point of view, but I think for Robin it was as accurate as he could get, as accurate a language as he could get, mm-hmm. you know. And as he says in that the transcript of that talk, it was published in Acts, the journal Acts, Acts 6, edited by Benjamin Friedlander and David Levi-Strauss. That, lost the train of my thought. Sorry, where was I going to go with that? That, yeah, he said these new forms of reading, right at the end of that essay, will give us, you know, they're great new tools with which we can read text, the deconstructive philosophies and hermeneutical methods of reading. But he says that they, you know, they can't, they should not blind us to the, if, I have to get this right, if they... They cannot themselves become the only way to read.
Right.
Yeah.
They're not giving us a way of being in the world.
No.
Right. They're good at tearing down what's not working, but they're not good at illuminating the path.
Yeah. And that, I think that's the argument that poetry has with philosophy, in a way, that what philosophy would call negation, poetry would call process. And you can say they're the same thing, but they're different. It's a different point of view.